Commons Conversations is a series of interviews in which campaigners share their experiences and insights into activism, learning in movements, and radical history. Produced by the Commons Social Change Library, episodes in the fourth series cover multicultural and First Nations voices from the climate movement, regional and rural organising, artivism, fierce vulnerability and radical resilience, the fight against corporate disinformation, campaigns countering the far right, and more. The 2025 to 2026 series can be heard on Saturday afternoons between 1 and 2pm in December and January on 3CR, or found as a podcast at 3cr.org.au/actingup or via commonslibrary.org.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
So welcome everybody to the Commons podcast. My name is Charlie Wood and I'm your host today. I'm a climate justice organiser, campaigner, trainer and therapist based on the lands of the Ngunnawal and the Ngambri people in so-called Australia. And I want to acknowledge that sovereignty of these lands was never ceded, and to also honour the ongoing wisdom, determination and connection to country of all First Peoples. Today we are joined by an amazing guest, Kazu Haga. Kazu is a trainer, educator, student and practitioner with over 25 years of experience in nonviolence and restorative justice. He weaves in lessons from decades of Buddhist practice and trauma healing work to advance social change and collective healing. Kazu teaches nonviolence, conflict reconciliation, restorative justice, organizing, and mindfulness in prisons and jails, high schools, universities, and youth groups, in faith communities, and with activist movements around the country. He spent a decade working in social justice philanthropy while directly being involved in and playing leading roles in many movements. He became an active nonviolence trainer in the global justice movement of the late 90s and has since led hundreds of workshops worldwide. So today, Kazu and I will be talking about his new book called Fierce Vulnerability, Healing from Trauma, Emerging from Through Collapse. This book masterfully and beautifully weaves together wisdom from the worlds of nonviolence, trauma healing, and spirituality to address some of the very biggest challenges and injustices of our time. So, Kazu, a big warm welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Really good to be with you.
Yeah, it's awesome to be with you too. Thank you for joining us today. And yeah, thank you for all the work that you do in the world and for this wonderful book. It's a real gift. So to kick us off, Kazu, I wonder if you'd be willing to share a little about what inspired this book to come into being.
Yeah, there's so many threads on that I could pull. I think part of it is just recognizing that oftentimes in my activist work, it didn't feel like the sincerity or like the energy with which we were caring about our work was proportionate to the depth of the crisis we find ourselves in. Like, I feel like oftentimes we were running campaigns where we would battle for, you know, 3, 4, 5 years to pass one piece of legislation when it feels like the world is collapsing all around us. Right, we are living in the midst of the climate crisis and multiple pandemics and war and genocide and all of these things. And it felt like we needed to shift some things and to be able to talk about things on a larger scale. And also, some friends of mine and I have been talking for many years about going into the spaces where we felt like had the most urgency around the issues of our day. Particularly frontlines communities that are engaged in nonviolent direct action work. And there was something about being in those spaces that is always inspiring because you see people who are willing to sacrifice and put their bodies on the line for something that they believed in. And at the same time, a lot of the energy that was that we were witnessing at a lot of these actions were no longer inspiring to us. One way that we talk about it a lot in the work of Fierce Vulnerability is that in a lot of activist spaces, we move with this energy of we're here to shut things down. And I totally get that, right? Like, we need to shut down these systems of injustice, these systems that are causing so much harm. And at the same time, as someone who is really committed to the process of healing, I know that shutting things down does not create healing. And if we want to bring healing into these spaces, we actually need to learn to open things up. And so we were asking these questions about what does it mean to be engaged in nonviolent direct action in a way that not only shuts things down, but opens things up? And how do we view nonviolent direct action as a modality of collective trauma healing? And so, you know, as we were playing with these questions and really trying to add to this ancient lineage of nonviolence, this thing called fierce vulnerability just emerged and kind of taught us what it's trying to be.
Yeah, I love that idea of how do we open things up as well as shutting down. And yeah, the fierce vulnerability term just captures it so beautifully. I wonder if we can sort of move on to a theme that comes up quite a lot throughout the book. And that is this theme around the kind of intertwined nature of both the personal and the systemic. And I often see in at least activist spaces that I'm part of that we can tend to sort of binarize the personal and the systemic. And, you know, we see it in our chants and mantras at rallies, like system change, not personal change. But I kind of worry that this clouds the reality that systems are made up of individuals and individuals are part of systems. So we actually all exist in this kind of complex fractal universe in which, you know, everything and everyone is interconnected. And I'd be really curious to hear more about what helped you to crystallize the connection between the two and how this kind of guides your own activism.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. I'll say first that I feel like there's a way in which fierce vulnerability is about neither individual or systemic change, depending on how we understand those terms. Like when I hear the word personal change or personal healing, I can't help but think of like the wellness industry and self-help and these things that are like part of capitalism, right? They're huge multi-billion dollar industries that really tells you that if you work on healing your own wounds, somehow the world will be better. And I think that the idea of personal liberation is a myth. Like there is no such thing as personal liberation in a deeply interdependent world, right? And at the same time, when I think about systemic change and systems change, I can't help think about changing policies and changing laws and legislation and things like that. And of course, those things are important and it's part of the picture. But fierce vulnerability is it's not about changing policy. It's about transforming mindsets and cultural norms and relationships that we have with each other and with the earth, right? Like capitalism is a system that needs to change, I believe. But it's also a deeply ingrained mindset that teaches us what and how to value things. And it teaches us what kind of relationship we're allowed to have with nature and to generosity and sustainability. And these are not just policies, right? These are things that are deeply ingrained in each of us. And so, you know, fierce vulnerability, like it's not just about wanting somebody else in the office of the presidency. It's about considering a world where we abolish the office of the presidency, where we no longer feel like we need to have one person at the top of the pyramid who wields so much power. I think when I talk about systems change, I want to use that word systems within a larger context of systems being these large, complex living organisms that are deeply interrelated with policies and structures and ecology and cultures and relationships and value systems, right? You know, you mentioned the word fractal. I know that as I've really committed to my own personal trauma healing journey, I got this like deeply embodied understanding of what healing means and what it looks like and what it takes. And I saw that a lot of other people didn't have access to that, right? They didn't have access, not just to therapy, but also to the relationships and the community and the nature and the spiritual practices that I had access to. Those were things that were explicitly taken from us. And so I understood that we need that kind of larger systemic change because not everybody has access to those healing modalities. But also as I got a much more embodied sense of what healing looks like and what the violence that I held inside my own body looks like, I had a much better understanding of what it means to heal our collective wounds and our collective trauma. So without understanding what it means to heal my own shadows, I don't feel like I'm in a position to point our fingers and demand that society heals its shadows.
So true. Yeah. And yet oftentimes I see that activism can almost distract or deflect people from doing that deep work on themselves, right? It's used as an outlet to do anything but tend to our own pain.
Absolutely.
I'm going to say our own pain. It's shared. It's not just our own, right?
Totally. And the same can be said about people who do personal healing work, right? Personal healing work can be used to bypass the fact that there are so many systems that are causing trauma at a rate that's so much faster than individual healing can happen.
So maybe kind of continuing on this theme around binaries, again, another kind of focus of the book. And you say that you feel like black and white sort of binarized thinking is actually, it's at the heart of what is destroying our planet. Strong agree from me on this one. I wonder if you can share a little bit more about how you see that play out in sort of social change and movement spaces and your thoughts on what we can do to kind of shift those mindsets.
I worked with an Indigenous teacher years ago who said that the kind of black, white, us versus them binary worldview is the most pervasive way that our minds have been colonized by the state. And I think, you know, a lot of fierce vulnerability is about learning from natural systems. And you look at natural ecosystems, natural systems, and there are no binaries, right? So like, I feel like binaries are toxic in so many areas of our lives. And one area where it's really toxic and that happens a lot in activist spaces is the good-bad binary, right? Like, we're the good people, they're the bad people over there. And it's such an easy binary to slip into because there's clearly injustice happening. There is harm happening. There's oppression happening. And it feels like there are people who are responsible for that harm. And at the same time, I have come to really understand that the worldview of us versus them relies on the delusion of separation, right? Like, it relies on the delusion that we don't belong to each other. And somehow my liberation is bound only with the liberation of the people that I like or that I agree with. And it doesn't depend on the people on the so-called other side. I've noticed that if you have this worldview that, like, we are over here and they are over there and our liberation comes at the expense of those people, then some part of you believes in a worldview of independence, which is a myth, right? In an interdependent world. And if you believe that we are separate beings that don't belong to each other, then I have to feel that some part of us has to constantly be living in fear that I don't also belong, or that my belonging is conditional, that I might get kicked out of this interwoven web of humanity. And so I think ridding ourselves of the binary of black and white and good and wrong is also about deepening in our own understanding and commitment to interdependence and to this worldview that I will never be free until you are free.
Yeah, beautiful. Powerful shift. It's hard for us. It's hard for us to do that, I think. Hey.
It's so hard. Yeah. It's so, because we've been so deeply conditioned in this way, right? Many of us have.
And thinking about how we would actually sort of shift those ways of thinking, I think spirituality comes up, right? As a place where we can draw lessons. And you talk about the importance of spirituality and social change. And I'm curious about what you see as the kind of biggest offerings that spirituality has to make activism and how we might sort of embed more spiritual practice into movement spaces.
I think one of the biggest gifts that spirituality gives us is breath, right? It helps us to remember to breathe deeply. It reminds us of the scales of change that we are experiencing right now and just the timing of change. Spirituality for me is deeply humbling. And sometimes it reminds me of how insignificant I am and how small I am. I talk about spirituality, like I use the word very broadly, right? I think I write in the book that I've always joked that the astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson is one of my biggest spiritual teachers. Because when I hear him talk about the cosmos, it reminds me of how insignificant I am. And I'm left with the same awe and mystery and inspiration that I'm oftentimes left with at the end of a spiritual retreat. And people like Neil deGrasse Tyson will remind us that this planet is what, 4.7 billion years old? And I've been around for 44 years. Like, just that humility, I think, reminds me to slow down. And that slowness is so important in this time of such fierce urgency. One of my favorite quotes comes from the US Navy SEALs, who teaches their soldiers that slow is smooth and smooth is fast. And that, like, in this urgent moment, we need to remember to breathe slowly so that we can be efficient and effective. You know, part of what slowness gives us is it gives us access to the part of our brain that is capable of thinking about nuance, that is capable of reminding ourselves that we are interdependent. Like when our bodies speed up, when our heart rate speeds up, there's something that actually happens to our brains and our bodies physiologically where we're the part of our brain that is capable of thinking about empathy and connection and all these things, it literally gets shut down, right? It's called the amygdala hijacking. And so I think spiritual practice, access to nature, like whatever you consider to be spiritual practice, reading about the cosmos in some scientific magazine. Spiritual practice to me are the practices that remind us that we are part of something much greater than our individual selves and that help us remember how big the cosmos is and how important it is to slow down in the midst of all of it.
Yeah, and how that sort of sense of urgency actually perpetuates the systems that we're seeking to change, because
right?
They're all about that. Makes me think of Bio Akamalafe's work of what if the way we respond to the crisis is the crisis, you know?
Yeah. Can I just say one more thing about Bio? I was reading an interview with Bio Akamalafe once, and he was talking about the need to slow down. He has another quote too. I think he says, times are urgent, we must slow down. And he says, you know, sometimes he gets criticism or at least questions about we don't have the privilege to slow down. We don't have time. Look at the urgency of this time. And he responds by saying, slowing down is not a function of time and speed. Slowing down is a function of deepening our awareness and noticing who is around us. And I love that understanding of what it means to slow down.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, I'll be sharing that widely because, I come up against that often in space, activist spaces.
Totally.
People sort of get it at an intellectual level, but then when they try to put it into practice, they feel this, it's like this inner conflict. It strikes me that, when we kind of try to do this work on ourselves and we confront that kind of urgency mindset and the feelings that come up inside of us, that often we hit up against a lot of guilt and shame, particularly activists. And kind of going back to this idea of each of us being a fractal, I wonder about to what extent do you think activist feelings of shame, of not enoughness, actually kind of contribute to this larger culture of not enoughness that are at the heart of some of our biggest crises, particularly thinking about things like climate change. And also how we might kind of go about starting to transform some of those feelings of shame and not enoughness.
Yeah, it's funny. I feel like just 2 hours ago, I was talking to my therapist and this was like the central theme of our discussion. I think the guilt and shame, and it's not just as activists, right? I'm a Japanese person and Japanese culture is so rich with guilt and shame. This is capitalism at work. Right? Making all of us feel like we are not enough and therefore we need to depend on capitalism to become whole and complete. And I think as activists, though, it is so important that we become aware of these dynamics that are alive in all of us, to accept that and to say, it's actually okay that we have guilt and shame. We just need to accept it so that we can be with it and work with it. Because if we don't, we replicate it in our own movement spaces by shaming other people, right? Whether it's shaming people within our own movements or shaming people that are supposedly outside of our movements. And we can't shame people into transformation, right? Shaming people is not an effective tactic of helping them heal, helping them become more whole, helping them realize that they can be doing better in this world, right? And to me, social change is about supporting people and becoming their best selves. There's a famous quote from Brené Brown who says, shame derives its power from being unspeakable. When we don't speak about the things that we are most ashamed of, then it just ends up controlling our lives and it has ripple effects and it impacts the relationships that we build. It impacts our capacity for creativity and compassion and all of these different things. And at the same time, in a lot of the healing work that I've done, a lot of the circles that I've led, when we are able to create space for people to talk about the things that they are most ashamed of, it is the scariest conversation in the world. But if we can create that power, it is some of the most liberating spaces I have ever seen in my entire life, right? When people can speak to the things that they are ashamed of and trust that on the other side of that conversation is not isolation, but it's actually a deeper sense of belonging. right? So if we can create more and more of these spaces where we really trust that if we can speak about the things that we are most ashamed of, we can actually deepen in community and deepen in relationship, then I feel like we can create movement spaces that don't feel a need to threaten anyone else's sense of belonging in order for us to create the changes that we need to see in the world.
Yes, yeah, so true, so powerful. Spaces for sharing and talking about our shame. And I imagine then that will also bring up other feelings, right? Like grief, like rage, like anger. And you talk about these things a lot as well. Can you say a little bit more about why tending to grief and rage and anger are important?
Yeah, in a lot of nonviolent spaces, in a lot of healing spaces, in a lot of spiritual spaces, I think we don't do a good enough job of honoring grief and rage. You know, especially in a lot of like spiritual places, we bypass the grief and the rage and we end up like suppressing it, you know? And we say that people are expressing rage, then they're not practicing nonviolence or they need to learn to meditate better, things like that. But there are, of course, spiritual traditions that create really powerful spaces and containers explicitly for us to work with emotions like grief and rage. You know, a lot of Vajrayana Buddhist traditions, an elder who recently passed away, Joanna Macy, a lot of the work that she did created a lot of space for grief. And, you know, grief and rage are not only powerful emotions, but they're like righteous and natural emotions, right? Like if we are aware of what's going on in the world, people should be in grief and rage. It is a natural response to witnessing and living through a lot of what we have to live through. And if we don't create safe containers for those emotions to be witnessed and honored and expressed, they either seep out unknowingly and harm our relationships with each other, or we end up burning out, right? Like, I feel like it takes an incredible amount of spiritual and emotional energy to constantly be telling ourselves that everything is fine, right? To constantly deny a truth that your body knows to be true, which is that we need to grieve. We need to express our outrage at the world. And so, you know, similar to expressing shame, I feel like if movement spaces can create more and more containers where these really powerful emotions can be expressed in safe containers, then we can let the burning inferno of grief and rage burn so that we can find the gift that's beneath it, so that we can find the charcoal that we can use to heat up food and keep ourselves warm, right? And so I think it's really important that we find explicit safe containers where all shame, grief, rage, all these things can be honored so that we can be in better relationship with these emotions.
Absolutely. It's often the fear of the emotion rather than the emotion itself that is the hardest, right?
Totally.
And I think it's Joanna Macy, but I think drawing from her Buddhist practice that has this beautiful quote about, you know, when you let yourself, I won't remember it exactly, but when you let yourself to kind of feel the grief of the world, it breaks your heart open and that builds this capacity for love that is sort of unprecedented. So there's something in the feeling of these emotions, particularly grief, that connects to love. And I'm keen to come back to love a little
Absolutely,
later.
But... Yeah.
And on this sort of topic around Buddhism, you talk about the impermanence of all things and this sort of liberation of surrender to the reality of what is happening to our earth, the importance of embracing emergence, of being able to hold space for paradox as we kind of work through complexity and uncertainty. And I think working on issues like climate change, social injustice, it really requires us to embrace that reality of impermanence. And I'm wondering how you kind of view this practice of non-attachment in social change and what you think it might have to offer.
Yeah, and I was just talking to my partner about this the other day, that even our sun will someday burn out. It is inevitable. That is the natural progression of the cosmos. But if we kind of scale down just a tiny bit from the lifespan of the sun, but still at a large level, like the changes that are happening on this planet right now are massive, right? The earth is going through transitions and transformations that in a lot of ways, we as human beings kind of like started the dominoes. But at this point, we've lost control. And to think that we can control climate is actually the worldview that got us into this mess of the climate crisis that we are in, right? And so there is no solving the climate crisis. The climate crisis is already here. I think one of the things that we need to do, again, to like humble ourselves, is to just accept that the changes that are happening on this planet right now are so much bigger than what we have control over. And we are no longer the change agents. Like, I feel like in my entire activist life, I've been trained to think of myself as like the agents of change, right? But I've had to do a lot of relearning over the last 10 years or so. And part of that relearning is to accept that we are not the agents of change. The Earth is the agent of change. And the best we can do is to be in right relationship with the changes that are happening at a scale that is so large that our intellect alone cannot comprehend. It doesn't mean we just give up and say, oh, the Earth is going through these changes, so whatever. We need to continue to be passionate about life and about protecting life and affirming life, but also become more detached to the specifics outcomes of our movement, because we don't know what being back in right relationship with Earth is going to look like. The Earth knows, but we cannot comprehend. There's a beautiful quote that's someone once said, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. Like, I can imagine 50 ways we might destroy the planet, but what would a post-capitalist world look like? What would a world look like if we're actually back in right relationship with each other and the Earth? I don't know. So I need to let go of this idea that if I think long and hard enough, I can figure it out and I can figure out a work plan from A to Z that gets me to collective liberation, because that's not how liberation works. We just need to love enough and care enough about our lives and our communities and all the beauty that we still do have and fight like hell for it, while also being detached to specific outcomes in the way that I've been trained as an activist.
Yeah, wonderful. I'm thinking about how, and you use the word detached, I think sort of synonymously with non-attachment, but I wonder, it seems like there's a fine line between practicing non-attachment in the way that you describe and then maybe slipping into a place which is a less healthy form of detachment, right? Where you feel almost resigned and disconnected. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about how to hold that in-between space and prevent ourselves from kind of sliding into that detachment. Or maybe we can't. Maybe that's just a natural part of being a human in this world. But I'm really interested in your thoughts.
Yeah, it can definitely be a slippery slope. I feel like it's related to the conversation that I love to have around the idea of surrender. And for me, I found such great liberation in surrender. And surrender is another one of those words like that if we misunderstand, we could say, oh, I give up, right? But surrender to me in the liberating sense is not about giving up. It's certainly not about giving up on hope or on life or on beauty or on community. It's about giving up the delusion of control, right? Like, there's not much we can do to control the outcomes of the things that we do in our lives, even the outcomes of our movements. But that is a very different thing than saying, I give up on life and I give up on hope and I give up on change. I am going to work as hard as I can to continue to affirm life and to create beauty and to create relationships and strengthen community. But I'm giving up on the delusion that I used to live in, that if I work hard enough, I can control all the outcomes of my actions. I'm going to give everything I can, because I can control what I put out into the world, right? Like, I can control how I show up. So I'm going to give everything I can to showing up in a way that I feel like will contribute to the changes that I want to see. And then from that point, I just have to let it go and have faith that the universe will take care of itself. But I do need to control. I do need to be intentional about how I show up in the world and how I show up in community and relationships.
Love that. Thank you. And yeah, this connects to my kind of next pondering, which is around, you know, connected to this resignation, maybe less sort of healthy form of detachment. I guess I've noticed in some spaces this sense of maybe seeping cynicism, maybe a little whittling away at visions for kind of bolder, more hopeful, just futures in recent years. And maybe that's been propelled in some parts by the pandemic, perhaps the growing complexity of like living in these times of polycrisis and the overwhelming impact that that has on our bodies and our hearts and our minds. And you talk about how, you know, none of us have experienced what's on the other side, and that the unknown is always going to be scary. And Rutger Bregman talks about this in his book, Utopia for Realists, too, about how visionaries, they've often throughout history been attacked, been pilloried, often even pathologized for having these beautiful visions. And so I wonder what you think is needed to protect and to grow bold, beautiful visions in these times when there are, unfortunately, so many kind of cynical naysaying forces that are trying to cut them down.
Yeah, I really resonate with that. You know, I've been in movement spaces for, I don't know, almost 30 years. And in that time, I've certainly had a lot of movement heartbreak. You know, there's been so many moments, especially in my younger activist days, where I was like, oh, the revolution is here. And then it didn't happen. And I get really cynical.
Damn it. Yeah.
You know, but, you know, again, I think about it at the largest scale. Like, if you go out into space, there is no front, back, left, right, up, down. There's just space. You know, in the Fierce Vulnerability book, I talk about in Mahayana Buddhism, there's a distinction made between what's called ultimate reality and relative reality. There's different words for it sometimes, but relative reality is the world that we typically live in, right? It's where things are a little bit more black and white. Things are a little bit more linear. It's the realm of Newtonian physics. Like, we can really understand things intellectually, but there's also this ultimate realm that we're constantly swimming in that is much more mysterious and is not linear at all. So I feel like in the relative world that we live in, I feel like it's important that we really look for the so-called small moments that can give us access to the largest, most powerful visions. I oftentimes feel like, you know, like, because we live in just the relative world and we don't have a good understanding of the ultimate, I've been taught that in order to have like the biggest imaginations, we need to be part of movements that are like where millions of people are pouring into the streets and we can really like imagine a worldwide revolution. But perhaps that worldwide revolution is not going to happen that way. It's not going to happen in like the large scale that we've always imagined, but it's going to happen in these small pockets. I'm deeply inspired by the fact that the largest living organism in the world is an underground network of mycelium that lives in the northern part of the state of Oregon in the United States. Yeah, it's the largest living organism in the world. And if you were just walking on the forest floor, you wouldn't even know that it was underneath you, right? Because it's below ground. But given the right conditions of rain and humidity, it creates mushrooms and fungi across the entire forest floor. And it's actually part of one living organism. And so the reason I'm sharing this is because I feel like if we're looking for these like big, bold, powerful movements where millions of people are pouring into the streets, we don't always see it, but we see constant small examples of alternatives that are happening. Like, I live in a community in Lisjano Ohlone land, in land currently called Oakland, California, traditionally called Hu Trin. I live in a community called Canticle Farms, and it's a community of 11 homes, a tiny home and a yurt. There's about 40 of us that live together, diverse across every identity marker you can imagine, multiple languages. My daughter's 14 months old, 15 months old, is the youngest, and the oldest is like in their 80s. And we're all living together in the midst of the collapse, trying to figure out what it means to do healing work and social justice work and live in a village. And it's just 40 of us. It's not 40 million people, but it's 40 of us doing this deep, rich, beautiful experiment in community and village. And I'm inspired by the fact that I hear more and more examples of small communities like this popping up all over the place all the time. Right. And so to not underestimate the importance of these small examples of beauty and community and life affirmation that we see, even if it's just like walking across the forest floors and noticing a really beautiful flower. That moment right there shows you everything you need to know about Earth's capacity to create beauty, right? And that's all we need to have an access point to a much larger vision of what it would look like to be living in a life-affirming world. And so, yeah, I think rather than looking up for the big, bold visions, look down, you know, look by your feet, look where you're standing.
That's so wonderful. It reminds me of an amazing Indian activist who I met, who explained to me why he didn't call himself a climate activist, because he felt like that located him too abstractly, like too up in the cloud discussions of emissions. And he's like, no, I work with people and places down on the ground. And so he was very, very intentional about the way that he described that. And I think I see it myself often, this pull to kind of scale and largeness and bigness that actually maybe draws away from tending to the beauty of the small. And it makes me also think about the work of John Paul Lederach, amazing peace builder, who talks about the importance of the critical yeast in transforming conflict, right? That it's actually tending to the connections between a small number of people that then leads to the critical mass that can actually change things on a really big scale. But if we ignore the small, we don't get to the large.
That's right.
So we touched on love before, but I feel like it's permeating everything in this discussion and in your book as well. A friend of mine a few years ago wrote an essay which was sort of encouraging activists to choose love over hope. And she talked about how she felt the goodness and rightness of action isn't measured by hope of success. And her kind of thesis was that love is a motivation that transcends technocratic and political arguments about whether it's possible to prevent things like catastrophic climate change, and that it can still kind of motivate action even from a place of despair. And you talk about the power of love in healing injustice. And so, yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the love versus hope. Maybe they don't need to be versus each other. And I guess just the power of love more broadly in activism and social change.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It feels related to some of what we were talking about earlier. But yeah, I feel like, yeah, what are the metrics of love being successful? Like, if I love deeply, then what else do I need? Right? Like, do I need something to happen to manifest in the world in a physical way for my love to be valued or valid? Right, like I think me expressing my love is perhaps enough. And again, I want to be careful because this sounds like it's a slippery slope to some of these arguments of like, oh, we just need to love everyone and the world will heal itself. Yeah. And you know, like I think that's a really dangerous argument, right?
Yes.
But if I truly love life and if I truly love the world, then I will do everything I can to protect life. And it's not true love if I say, oh, I love all people, but meanwhile, there's a genocide going on right now and I'm not doing anything about it, right? Like, what kind of love is that? And so, you know, one of my favorite quotes by Dr. Martin Luther King is when he said, power without love is reckless and abusive, and love without power is sentimental and anemic. That when we express power in the absence of love, it can be reckless and abusive and destructive. But at the same time, if we are expressing love in the absence of power, it is weak, it is sentimental, it is anemic, it doesn't have the power to actually change the conditions that are causing so much suffering to the beings that we say we love, right? And so I think it's important to acknowledge that if I'm saying that I love life, and if I'm saying I love humanity, then I will do everything I can to protect them from harm, even if I know that it may not be possible. Like if someone is harming my child, I'm not going to sit there and say, is my response in trying to protect my child going to be effective or not? Like, that's not even part of the equation. I'm just going to jump in and do what I can to protect my child, right? And and so I think true love is not about measuring whether it's going to be effective or not. It's about recognizing that something that I deeply care about is experiencing harm and doing everything I can to try to stop it.
So building on this piece around emergence, and you suggest beautifully that we need theories of being rather than theories of change. And I guess it strikes me that, you know, we're facing so many existential crises today precisely because we've sort of collectively fallen out of alignment with nature, the Tao. We've kind of lost our way. And as such, maybe finding ways to tune back into our sense of intuition, to listen to our bodies, to follow more natural ways of being, and weaving these back into ways of living and activism is quite key to transforming the crises that we face. And so I wonder what you think about that and how we can teach ourselves to tune back into ourselves and nature, which we are as well, to live in more emergent ways as activists.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm kind of playing with words a little bit, but this idea of a theory of change, which, you know, every campaign, every movement, every nonprofit is supposed to have, I fear that we are slipping into this worldview where we can have a really beautiful infograph that maps our path to liberation. And again, I think it's that worldview that tells us that we can figure it out, quote unquote, that we can think long and hard enough and we can figure out how to get out of this mess. It's that worldview that has partially got us into this mess. And that's not to say that there isn't a role for the intellect, right? Like I believe that as we build movements, we do need to be really intentional and strategic about our analysis and the structures that we use and all of that. But to also recognize that our world has for too long been led only by the intellect, and that has created an imbalance. The world that has been created out of the intellect alone has come at the expense of our intuition and has come at the expense of the wisdom of our bodies and the relationships that we have with our ancestors and the relationships that we have with the beyond human world, right? And so, you know, I'm oftentimes thinking about things like, what would it mean for social movements to actually not be so reactive all the time and think about what it would mean to align our work with the seasons, right? Like every species on this planet is deeply aligned in how it lives its life according to the seasons. And human beings also used to live that way for like 98% of our history. And somehow today, whether it's corporate work or movement work, the timing of the seasons don't matter. Whether it's winter, summer, spring, whatever it is, we just go about doing our 9 to 5. And that doesn't make sense. So like, would our movements work a little bit differently if we were a little bit more mindful of what it means to be in relationship with the seasons? What would it look like not just to use our intellect and collect the data and try to understand what policies need to be shifted, but to sit by a river together with our movement colleagues for a week and not talk and just listen to the river? Like, what might happen? I was just having a conversation with someone earlier today with someone from an organization in the United States called the Pachamama Alliance. And they do these like earth listening circles. And on September 21st, they're trying to plan this International Day of Listening where activists who are doing climate work just go out into nature and listen. My friend Xiao Rong, who's part of the Fierce Vulnerability Network, is a therapist who's also been guiding people into like helping to go out into nature and just seeing what we can hear. And so, you know, not to throw away the intellect, but to bring a little bit more intention and value to other sources of wisdom, I think is really important in this time when there's so much happening to the earth and so much that the earth is moving through, right? I think we need to listen to it a little bit.
Yeah, wonderful. I love that invitation to listen to the river. And it makes me think of Thich Nhat Hanh's work of, you know, his invitation to listen to the sounds of the earth crying and to feel your back to the grief, to feel your grief, because that expands your heart and your capacity to act.
Absolutely. And to connect with that larger body, right? The grief that is alive in our bodies is the same thing as the grief that is alive in the earth right now.
So to see direct action is a big part of this book, and you talked about it at the start, the genesis of it, and about this feeling that sort of contemporary direct action is missing something. It's missing an energy or an atmosphere. And you invite us to think about what it would look like to see the work of direct action as ceremony, which I just think is such a beautiful invitation. And I'm curious if you have thoughts to share on this with us and what that could look like and what this could offer.
You know, I had the privilege to spend a little bit of time at Standing Rock back in 2016 or whenever it was. It was at the time the largest gathering of Indigenous peoples in the history of humankind, right? Indigenous people from all over the world to be in solidarity with the Lakota and the Dakota people over there. And it was there when I first heard one of the elders tell us as we were getting ready to go into town to engage in direct action. I was like, remember, you all are going there to engage in ceremony. Like, that's what that is. Mm-hmm. And so it really shifted my worldview, and I've been thinking about it nonstop ever since. So yeah, what would it look like to engage in nonviolent direct action as if it was ceremony and ritual? How do I prepare myself to enter ceremony versus how do I prepare myself into direct action? And why is it so different? Like, do I come back from a ceremony and measure its effectiveness based on some tangible outcome? Or do I accept that there's a lot more mystery to the changes that happen in my body and in my spirit after a ceremony? And what would it look like, again, to like let go of this attachment to seeing immediate outcomes in direct action and see that there's more mystery there? There are organizations that I want to lift up, you know, apologies for being US-centric, but this is where I live. Organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace or the Poor People's Campaign, or If Not Now, that are doing direct action in a way that feels deeply like ceremony. Particularly, you know, organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace and If Not Now, who are doing a lot of Palestine solidarity work, they're so deeply rooted in their cultural and spiritual traditions, and they use that as the tools for creating change, right? So if you go to a direct action, they might be using their bodies to shut down City Hall or what, or Congress or whatever it might be, but they're praying and they're singing songs and they're lighting candles. And that just feels different than holding up signs and chanting and yelling. And neuroscience actually will tell you that there's a difference between like chanting slogans and singing spiritual songs. Like, it does a different thing to you, like neurologically, right? It creates more openness for connection and healing. And so, yeah, what would it look like if we, instead of yelling more and chanting more, we sat in silence or sang songs? And what would it look like or if our direct actions were more invitational and asking questions as opposed to forcing demands? One kind of fantasy direct action I've had for a couple of years that I wrote about in the book is like, what would happen if a group of activists blockaded a major intersection in downtown somewhere, some city, and then a group of artists and dancers and ceremony leaders led a grief ritual in the middle of that intersection? And then we had healers and therapists and restorative justice facilitators there who were pulling people from like passersby into the ritual and asking them what they're witnessing and what's going on for them. Like, what would happen? It's still a nonviolent direct action that could be tied to a campaign. We're still shutting down an intersection or doing it in the middle of City Hall. But what if we looked at it as we're here for a ceremony and we're here to help people grieve. We're here to help people be angry. We're here to help people feel emotions that are so repressed in them that we can't get out of the delusion that keeps telling ourselves that everything is fine.
Oh, we should totally make that action happen.
we're hoping.
I'm excited. Yeah, no, I was feeling all warm as you're describing it inside of me. It's wonderful. Yeah, so, so good. Well, maybe coming to our kind of final question, we can end with endings. And you talk about the importance of embracing death and endings and transition processes and social change. And Adrienne Marie Brown talks about this too in relation to kind of movement organizations and the need to do a better job at sunsetting groups and campaigns once they've achieved what they set out to do, rather than trying to build legacies and empires and keep things alive when they've actually run their course. And of course, that's a really makes sense when we think in terms of kind of movement ecology and natural systems and processes. And so I wonder how you think we can do a better job at embracing death and endings and transitions in movements, and also maybe why we find it often quite hard to do that.
Yeah, I want to recommend two resources for people. One, for folks that don't know, is a book called Hospicing Modernity, which was one of the most inspirational books that I read in some time, that really talks about the scale of change in a way that I think is actually happening. And just talking about what it means to become hospice care workers and death doulas to these dying systems and empires, and how, rather than grasping to them, how we can help it release. And then there's another organization that my partner works with called SOUL, which is an acronym for the School of Unusual Life Learning. And they
wonderful.
Like, whole life philosophy through SOUL, I've learned that we live in such a death phobic world, because partly because we are taught that there's life and then life ends at death. But what I learned from Soul is that death is not the end of life. It is not in opposition to life. It is an integral part of life, right? And once we can accept death as not the end of life, but a really important part of the cycle of life, then we can have a much more like relaxed relationship and a healthier relationship with death and dying and ending, because it's not the ending of something, it's the beginning of something else. Anytime something dies, it becomes, you know, we were talking about our elder Joanna Macy, who passed away, and my partner talks about how, you know, you've lived a good life when your death becomes a village making event. And after the Joanna Macy, I'm seeing so many groups and communities come together to honor her life, and so many relationships that are being birthed out of that, right? When a tree falls in the forest and dies, within months it becomes a nurse log that becomes the home for so much new life, right? And so,
yes,
you know, in the research for my book, Fierce Vulnerability, I had a conversation with like 20 death doulas and hospice care workers. And the one thing that almost every single one of them said is the importance of normalizing death, that we actually experience death every single day, and how our kind of capitalist heteronormative Western cultures don't have things like rites of passage, where we acknowledge that as a young person is entering into adulthood, that is the death of their childhood. And when I became a parent for the first time, that was the death of my life of someone who had never been a parent, right? As I heal from the pain and the legacy of patriarchy, the part of me that has always lived in a patriarchal worldview is dying. And that is actually, it's a little scary still, because I don't always know what's on the other end, but it's something to celebrate, right? And so I think whenever we notice transition points in our lives, to really pause and to mark it and to acknowledge it as the death of one thing and the birth of another, I think will help us really have a healthier relationship with transitions. And that will then help us to have a healthier relationship with what's happening in the world today.
Powerful stuff. Thank you, Kazu. I think before we kind of formally wrap up, just wondering if there's anything else that you would like to share that we haven't kind of touched on so far.
Yeah, I'll just share really quickly a brief story that's in the book as well. Years ago, I got to meet, I'll share the very short version of it, a woman, an indigenous elder named Cynthia, who her son had been murdered 20 years prior to that. And she reached out to a group that I was working with because she wanted to have a restorative dialogue with the men responsible for her son's murder. And so after six months of prep, we went into Folsom State Prison, old Folsom State Prison in California, and brought Cynthia face to face with Richard, who was one of the men convicted of her son's murder. And it is a magical day that I will never forget. I remember going into the prison and sitting Cynthia down and going around the corner and getting Richard. And, you know, Richard was already shaking. And as soon as we got up and turned the corner, he saw Cynthia at the end of the hall, and he just collapsed into tears as soon as he saw her. And Cynthia saw him from the other end of the hall, and she stood up and walked towards him and just opened up her arms and embraced him in a hug that felt like it lasted 3 hours. And at one point in the conversation, Cynthia was holding Richard's hands, and she was saying, "I had a dream that I needed to hold your hands because these are the hands that took my son's life away, and I need to have a different relationship with them." I am sharing this story with their permission because I need all of us to remember that this is us, right? Like, this is our species. Our species is capable of experiencing the homicide of your child and then healing enough that you can hold the hands of the person who took your child's life away and to help him heal, right? Like, that is resilience that we are capable of as a species. And if that is possible between two individuals named Cynthia and Richard, then that is possible between nation states. It is possible between genders. It is possible between us and the earth. And I think it's so important that we remember how resilient we are as a species and the depth of healing that we are capable of.
Whew, wow. What a powerful story. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, so much love and humility and gratitude towards Cynthia and Richard for the incredibly difficult work that they had to go through to get there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Kazu, thank you so much again for joining us today. And yeah, your work is so powerful. It's such a beautiful gift to the world. So just really want to honor that and thank you for all that you do and all that you are in the world.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you so much for having me and for all the work that you do in the world.
The Commons Social Change Library is an online collection of educational resources for those campaigning for social change. It collects, curates, and distributes the key lessons and resources of progressive movements around Australia and across the globe. The library includes over 500 resources covering campaign strategy, community organising, activist history, digital campaigning, diversity and inclusion, and much, much more. It's free to access the library, so check out the collection at www.commonslibrary.org. Commons Social Change Library is a 3CR supporter.